bruised and bleeding, dress ripped and torn. She just managed to get the words out. "Joe, please, the children, think of the children." Then he lunged at her, the glass shard aimed at her throat. Danny's eyes widened in fear and he whispered, pleading to his mother, "Shoot him!" A shot rang out. Danny opens his eyes and sees his mother staring at him, deeply upset that he had to experience that, pain that he remembers it so vividly.
"One single shot, straight between the eyes, like the bullock."
Danny's voice cracks as he comes to terms with what he has witnessed.
"Dead."
Molly is at a loss. She tries with all her might to hold back her emotions.
I'm so sorry, Danny."
She holds her arms open and he comes to her, sinking into her embrace, shielded and comforted by his mother's love. They hang on to each other for dear life. They sit there for a long time, holding each other. There is no crying, just relief. Finally, Molly breaks the silence.
"Our secret, Danny."
It's not a question but a statement. Molly doing what she needs to do to survive. Danny, forever the good abiding son, nods.
"Promise me."
"Yes, Ma."
She kisses him gently on the forehead and suddenly realizes the other children aren't with him. Pushing him back to arm's length, she asks where they are. The boy is too scared to respond. Molly tries to read his silence.
"Did you say something, Danny? Where are your brothers and sister?"
"Miss Shirley told that judge fella. Called us octoroons. What's that, Ma?"
Molly's world slows around her and her stomach turns. She remembers this word, or a word very like it. When she was 8 years old and spending time with Miss Shirley, she heard Miss Shirley talking to another woman, and it was this woman who was informing Miss Shirley about a place to send Molly away to.
"A home for this mixed-blood child, if you believe the father's drunken ramblings to be true, would be better for her. She can't be left to her father's devices. She needs cleansing of the filth that courses through her veins. The less she knows, the better. You only have to tell them she's a quadroon and she'll be sent away."
Molly knows the word octoroon will get her children taken. It all makes sense now with the story Yarika told her. The pieces of her life's puzzle are falling into place. The past is making sense of the present. Slowly, a change comes over her. Her whole demeanor becomes that of a woman. No, a mother scorned. Silhouetted by the full moon, two people on horseback race across the plain. It's Molly and Danny. She with her trusty shotgun slung across her back. Joe's boots are tied to her duffel bag and she rides the trooper's horse. Danny has another duffel bag of supplies and is holding the killing spear Yarika gave him. He's riding his father's horse. Molly is focused. She drives her horse hard, digging her heels into its flanks. Chapter 28. Nate Klintoff stands frustrated at his bedroom window, looking out at the full moon. It's early morning but still dark. Soon dawn will be upon them. Louisa coughs violently and, waking herself, reaches across the bed and feels for her husband. He's not there.
"Nate?"
Sleepily, she looks around the room. Nate is lost in thought. All that he has learnt and heard plays over and over in his mind. Trooper Spencer Leslie has not returned with Molly Johnson. They should have returned a few hours ago if all went to plan.
"Nate?"
He finally speaks.
"You believed her?"
Taken aback by the absurd question, Louisa is bothered by his lack of concern for her.
"I'm fine, thank you for your concern."
Sighing with regret, Nate comes back to sit on the bed, taking his wife in his arms.
"I'm sorry. Can I get you anything?"
"No, thank you."
Louisa shifts a little, seeking better eye contact.
"Who were you referring to?"
Kissing her forehead, Nate diverts his eyes.
It doesn't matter. Louisa pushes herself away a little to get a better look at him and says, her voice slightly raised,
"Well, it must. You're standing at the window at this ridiculous hour of the morning."
She remembers her sick son, now sleeping peacefully beside them in his cot, and throws him a quick glance. She doesn't want to wake him. It's been a rough night. The boy gives a little sniffle. She coughs again, quickly burying it in her handkerchief. Nate looks at her forlornly.
"Molly Johnson."
She said, "Love watching my Joe cantering, coming home, waving his hat with joy." Louisa takes a second, deeply concerned for Molly, and adds,
"No, I didn't. Somehow it didn't ring true. It was more like a vision she'd dreamt up to impress us. The look on her children's faces kind of gave it away too."
Nate shakes his head. He doesn't want to say it.
"I think she killed him, murdered her husband."
"Nate, what would make you say such a thing?"
"There was a smell around the wood heap. The bittersweet smell of death. I've smelt it before, in war. Shallow graves, rotting flesh, death."
There's silence between them, each conscious of each other's individual fight for justice. Louisa considers and says,
"A mother's love, Nate. Unconditional, eternal. To protect, stops at nothing for her children's sake. Not that I wish death upon anyone. But I am sorry, Nate. There's only so much one can bear before, especially out here, and having no one to turn to for help."
Tension rises between Louisa's cause and Nate's duty to uphold the law. Nate turns his gaze back to the window and the full moon, slowly falling to its slumber behind the western ranges. Louisa, determined to make her point, continues,
"For the boy, Danny, to think it's a father's right to maim his own?"
She stops herself, exhaling at the disgust she feels.
"I wouldn't blame her,"
she adds with great conviction. Nate looks at her bewildered.
"Really?"
He's exasperated.
"Well, damn it," she exhales. "I'm sorry. I still hurt, and I'm still angry over my sister's death."
Emotion catches in her throat. She is frustrated now.
"Oh, I don't know. Who knows, unless you were there in the moment, dealing with it."
Nate looks out the window again.
"Get some sleep," Louisa whispers.
"I've tried.
It's that blasted moon."
Louisa fluffs up her pillow and lies down. Nate is getting back into bed when he hears a distant rumbling. He listens closely and slowly turns back to the window. Louisa also picks up on the sound, lifting her head from the pillow to hear. Nate scampers over to the window. Their house sits back from the main thoroughfare to Everton. The rumbling sound gets louder. Racing past on their horses are Molly and Danny. Dust rising from the track. They are bound for Everton. Molly's judgment is blinded by her urge to get to her children. She should never have come this way, but it's the only route in and out of Everton, apart from through the thick scrub, and that would have delayed them. Molly wanted to slip in and out of town under the cover of night. But ironically, she has brought herself straight past the man who's been trying to see her for days. This time, her safety is not the only thing worrying him. Chapter 29. Out front of the McGuinness's stone cottage and the adjoining church, all appears well. The dull glow of a lamp shines through the closed curtain, left burning as a nightlight, perhaps.
"You've been good to me and my children over the years."
Her demeanour, deadly serious. Molly is clutching a piece of paper in her mouth as she speaks and ties and knots rope.
"And for that, I am very grateful. But..."
She is tying the hands of Miss Shirley and Father McGuinness. In shock, they sit gagged and bound before the fireplace in their nightclothes. There has been some resistance. Furniture lies strewn over the floor and a glass vase has been smashed. Molly moves closer to Miss Shirley, putting the paper in her face.
Damn you to hell for thinking you know what's best for my children.
With that, she turns and grabs some blankets and a bag of food from the dining table. Miss Shirley begins to cry from fear and relief. Their lives are being spared. Father McGinnis looks as if he might be having a heart attack. His eyes are wide and he is gasping for breath. Molly throws the piece of paper in the fire and the flames eat at the condemning words. Octoroons, removal necessary, permission granted, and the signature of Judge Eisenmenger. She leaves, slamming the door behind her. Her children sit in the back of the wagon in the backyard. Molly distributes the blankets between them and puts the food in, pushing it all the way to the seat up the front. She takes a moment and sees the fear etched in their innocent little eyes. The sight of their mother's bruised and battered face and the reality of what has just happened has made them very scared. They were woken from their sound slumber by the sounds of raised voices and furniture being knocked over. Then Danny raced into the room, urging them to get dressed and to grab blankets and pillows. The realization hits her, and Molly waves them over. Her three youngest crawl over, still half asleep, but happy to see their ma and brother nonetheless. Molly hugs and kisses them and traces her hand gently over each face. Is she searching for their Narrigo features? They don't understand her action. Danny watches from the front of the buggy, moved by his mother's gentleness and deep love for her children. Although unclear about what is going on, the three are full of love and admiration for her. Not wanting them to see her emotion, Molly takes a deep breath and looks at the sky. They all follow her gaze, wondering what she's looking at. Feel that stillness? That sharp cold? That sting in the air? Each child takes a moment to feel what their mother describes. Snow's coming, she says. She closes her eyes, refreshed by the cold sting in the very early morning. She takes another moment, another deep breath. The sharpness in the air hurts her lungs, the pain, no doubt, made worse by her cracked ribs. Shaking it off, she says, we gotta get going, and tomorrow we can build a snowman and make snow cakes. She kisses Delphi's smiling face and tucks the little girl's rag doll in under the blanket, wrapping it tightly around her daughter. She instructs the two boys to get back under the blankets to keep warm, to keep quiet, and to keep down. She checks the rope tied from the trooper's horse to the back of the wagon and throws a blanket to Danny. Wrap yourself in this, son, over your head. Anyone stops us, you're sick with influenza, very contagious. Cough a few times when I say that. We're going for help. Not a peep out of the rest of yous. She throws a horse blanket over them to conceal them. It now looks like she only has provisions under there, not children. She climbs up and takes the reins, snapping them taut over the rump of the horse. The buggy moves off with a lurch. Now, Danny, tell me again where we're heading. The horses and Sulky move down the dark back street as Danny goes through the detail of how to get to the cave, just as Yarika told Molly in the hope she and her family would join him. Thanks to Yarika, they will have a chance. Not just a chance of survival and a chance to remain as a family, but a chance to learn about who they are and feel the love and warmth of their large extended family. Even though the conditions will more than likely be pretty dire, at least the love of this new family will be pure. And hopefully they can have a few moments with this mob that are untouched and untarnished by the reality of the world they share. Danny repeats the directions for his ma.
Head northeast. When we get to the great water hole, keep to the right. We'll get to a ball patch. Keep to the left. Get to three boulders that look like three giant emu eggs. It's there.
They have to go back through Everton to head out of town. The wagon moves slowly down the main street, Molly trying to keep the noise to a minimum.
The cave is there with supplies, and in the spring, people.
Molly nods her approval, seeming a little distant now.
You tell 'em Black Mary, that's what you say, they'll know who you are then.
Who?
Danny inquires. Molly takes a moment as she shapes the foreign words in her mouth. And then with pride says,
they're our people, Danny.
Family. She looks down at him and finally smiles. Hope is clear in her eyes. With that moment of relief, Molly's adrenaline is subsiding and the pain of her injuries is very obvious now. She hunches over, holding her cracked ribs, her breathing shallow.
Ma?
Says Danny, concerned for her. Spent, she turns to him.
Ma, I won't never go a-droving.
This breaks her heart. She reaches for him, pulling him into her as she kisses his forehead, and he softly exhales, saying,
always with you.
Molly is grateful she has such a caring and thoughtful young man as her son. She must focus now as they approach the last establishment, the Stanlow Inn, before they are safely out of town. She looks to the road ahead, and who should she see but John McFarlane? Molly takes a second look, and yes, it's him all right. She can't believe it. Her eyes glaze over with hurt, and the world around her slows. Danny sees his mother's reaction. He looks at McFarlane, and he knows exactly who he is. His fist tightens around the spear that lies beside him. This is the man he saw do that terrible thing to his ma. This is one of the men who hanged Yattica. McFarlane staggers into the shadows to take a piss. Molly slows the horse and hands the reins to Danny, saying, go to the edge of town, leave that trooper's horse, and head straight for the cave. I'll catch yous up. You hear me, Daniel Johnson? Danny goes to say something, but his ma shuts him down. Not a word now, Danny, please. He grabs his mother's arm to stop her jumping from the wagon.
When I'm old enough, Ma, I'll come back to make the bastard pay. I promise, for you, for Yattica, I'll put this spear right through him.
Molly looks lovingly at her son, a look of deep, unwavering love. A knowing and an understanding passes between them. She feels for him, the predicament she has put him in, but scurries off into the shadows. An emotional Danny reluctantly snaps the reins and the wagon moves off down the dark street.
Don't look back. Keep going. Do as Ma says. She'll be fine. What the hell is she gonna do? Blast it? I need to turn this blasted wagon around and... No. Worry about getting my brothers and sister to safety. To the cave. My promise to Ma. She'll catch us up as she promised. She always keeps her promises.
Whether it's feigned confidence or he actually does believe what he is thinking, Danny snaps the reins again, encouraging the horse along. Around the side of the Stanlow, McFarlane takes a long piss and looks at the sky as he enjoys the relief. He takes in his surrounds, smiles to himself, and shivers a little at the crispness of the early morning. The sun has risen, but the mountain range blocks its rays. Then he jumps with fright.
What the fucking hell, woman?
Molly stands right in front of him. His face changes as if he has swallowed something sour. He aims the last of his piss at her feet, but Molly doesn't move. She just stares at him, summoning her courage from deep within. I need to do this. Stand here before you. To show you. To help me know that you mean nothing to me. You may have hurt me. Had your way with me, but you will not hurt or scare me or have your way with me ever again. Because I stand before you afraid, yes, but I will not succumb or surrender to it.
Damn you to hell, you bastard, for what you did to me. You had no right, no right at all. You have no control. You are nothing.
Unbeknown to Molly, tears are streaming down her face. McFarlane raises his eyes to lock with hers, and with a condescending smile, lifts his hand and wipes roughly at the tears on her face, then violently grabs her jaw.
You mountain women don't know when to walk away,
he snarls. Something passes through Molly's eyes. They glaze over, and she is gone. McFarlane's face distorts, and he gasps for air, feeling a pain so extreme that he can't manage a sound. His knees give way, taking him to the ground, so he is kneeling before Molly. Is he racked with guilt and asking for her forgiveness? His hands are over his groin, and now blood seeps through his trousers and fingers. Molly has castrated him. She turns her face to the early morning sky. It begins to snow. McFarlane finally topples over, still holding himself, his body draining of blood. The snowflakes hitting the ground quickly turn pink. A few flakes hit Molly's face and bring her out of her stupor. She gasps for breath, coughing and spluttering, then looks around her and sees what she has done. She is deeply and immediately remorseful. She holds back her cries, covering her mouth with her bloody trembling hands. Her whole body shakes. She scrambles to leave and turns straight into Sergeant Nate Clintoff. They look at each other, neither knowing what to do next. Nate is in shock too. He absorbs the sorry state of Molly's beaten face and her awkward stance as she holds her broken ribs, pain racking her body again as the adrenaline of the moment leaves her. Tears well in her eyes. He can't help but feel for her. But it's the fresh spray of blood on her hands and mouth that he can't get past. And of course the man dying before him. Nate witnesses the life leaving McFarlane's eyes. There is silence all around. Pure peace as the first of the sun's rays spread across the sky. The distant caw of the crow is heard. It's dawn. A new day. Molly's eyes flick in the direction her children went, willing them onwards. Her eyes are pleading. Nate is torn between his vow to uphold the law and rightful justice for the bruised and battered Molly Johnson. He hasn't seen wounds like hers since his time at war. Enough evidence and grounds for him to turn a blind eye and set her free. But he's found the trooper's horse tied up at the edge of town and must address the matter of a government-issued horse without its rider. And whether he likes it or not, the dead man at his feet. Molly is exhausted. There is no fight left in her. Her knees buckle and she falls to the ground, her head hanging low. Her voice meek and mild, almost inaudible. She makes a final plea. Please, my children. Chapter 30. 2.5 days have passed. Some of the bruises on Molly's face have blackened and the swelling is subsiding. The cuts have been attended to. She sings softly to herself.
And still I hope that the time will come when you and I will be as one.
She stands on a stool gazing out of a little cell window, the cell she occupies at the Everton jailhouse. She looks at the snow-covered land stretched out before her and sings.
Black, black, black is the colour of my true love's hair.
Heavy snow covers the ground.
No good for the children, she thinks.
Her gaze falls on the distant snow-covered mountains and she stares at them, willing her children to survive, to make the journey to Yarika's cave. Nate grabs a stool from the small desk once occupied by Trooper Spencer Leslie, and brings it over to her cell door. What's out there?
Life.
Through the bars on the floor, Nate slides a shot of warm brandy, attempting to keep her calm for what lies ahead.
They say it's going to be a very cold winter, unprecedented snowfall this year.
Really?
One of the old black trackers that came with the troopers from the north told me. I'm amazed at their profound knowledge of the ways of the land.
He pauses for dramatic effect.
He also said your children's tracks are gone.
There's a tiny glint of worry in her eyes. Nate softens his voice.
Where are your children, Mrs. Johnson?
His eyes drill into her back, hoping she feels his sincerity. He's made a promise to Louisa that he will ensure their safety.
I can help them.
I want to help them. The new peacekeeper of Everton can't help but feel a little guilty. I can't throw the guilt that niggles at me. Maybe I should have turned a blind eye to Molly's crime. Clearly it was the desperate act of a woman deeply wronged. But I took an oath to uphold the law, and there is already one murderer on the loose. Damn it. I haven't slept a goddamn wink, fighting myself over my decision and how everything has panned out for Molly. Not to mention the tension between Louisa and I escalating as a result. The Crown versus Molly Johnson. An all-male jury. Miss Shirley's declaration of Molly's mixed-blood heritage. The Crown's closing statement. Her hatred towards the white men killed by her hand is generational. Stemmed from the knowledge learnt about her heritage and her own mother's plight by the black man who was wanted for abhorrent murders. He, indeed, a callous murderer himself. He encouraged her to seek revenge. The hearing was biased, I know. But there was nothing I could do. The only witness to Molly's truth is Danny. And he is nowhere to be found. Poor Louisa. Talk about not sleeping. Fighting for all she's worth. Lobbying for legislation to help battered wives. But that's never going to go through in time to help Molly Johnson. Poor woman. Oh my God, what must she be going through? But it will help others. At least she'll die knowing that a change will come one day. And soon, if Louisa has anything to do with it. Nate is brought out of his thoughts by her voice. Molly hasn't said much to him over the few days she's been in custody. But now she's telling him. My children will have all the help, all the love they will ever need. It's her hope, anyway. There's a dull jolt in the sound of laughter. It's not boisterous, just filled with satisfaction and jubilation. Molly cranes her neck to see to her right. A bag of flour swinging from a gibbet. A ringed slipknot noose tight around the sack. Troopers are checking the tautness of the rope and the craftsmanship of the structure they have just erected. It's brand new and holds up pretty well. Preparations are complete for the town's first execution. The execution of Molly Johnson, a drover's wife. She's making history today. The troopers pick up their tools, idly chatting. Molly brings her focus back to the mountains in the distance, the snow-dusted snow gums that border the boundary of cleared land for the expansion to Everton, and begins to hum softly. The front door to the jailhouse bursts open and in bustles Louisa Clintoff, flustered. She is holding a tray of hot food and a pair of blood-red shoes and has a musk-pink dress draped over one arm. The shoes are the ones she wore to the ball in Melbourne, held in her and Nate's honour. Nate moves to greet her, but she steps back, a frostiness still between them. She is more concerned with Mrs. Johnson than with showing affection to her husband. In a hushed but stern tone, she says, "Sorry, Nate. Sorry to intrude." "Louisa, this is no place for a woman." Nate wishes he could take back his words as soon as they leave his mouth. "Really? Well, there's a woman in there, behind bars and awaiting execution," Louisa retorts. "There must be something we can do to get a stay of execution. Has a doctor examined her, her mind? She's just given birth and lost a child and fears for her others. Nate!" "Louisa, please. The evidence against her is mountainous. I witnessed the murder of one man, the knife in her hand before me, his blood splattered on her face. So you saw her battered face under his blood. That could be considered an act of provocation. Nate, we heard the boy's assumption about your injury. That mindset is indicative of what they live with. Mrs. Johnson has experienced cumulative abuse at the hands of her husband. We have no witnesses. There rarely are." They stare each other down, both determined to hold their position on this. Nate reluctantly says, "And she's confessed." This hits Louisa hard, like a punch to the stomach.
Nate can only offer a lame smile. He loves his wife dearly and admires her caring and determined spirit, her intelligent mind and her sharp wit. Knowing she is defeated for now, she offers. Is she allowed a nice meal and a change of clothes? Holding out his hands, Nate says,
Thank you. I'll see that she gets it.
But Louisa maneuvers past him and makes her way over to the cell. As she approaches, her bravado disappears with each step.
Hello?
She says. Molly continues humming and looking out the cell window. Louisa is a little lost as to what to say next.
Please, I'm here as
There's a long silence. Molly doesn't move or say anything. Louisa's idea seems foolish now, and she turns to go.
You put up a good argument there.
Quickly turning back to Molly, Louisa takes this opportunity to reach out to her.
Telling the sergeant, or me, where your children are would be far better. Danny would be such a great help to you and your case.
Molly turns to face Louisa. And if he's not? Louisa can't answer. They see me die. They're dragged through this for what? And then what happens? Where will they go? Who will watch over them? Molly pauses, letting her words hang in the air. She knows Nate is listening. She hopes to make them understand her reasons for not talking.
No, I die knowing they're safe and protected and loved by family.
Hesitantly, Louisa adds,
You can't be sure of that either.
With no hesitation at all, Molly comes back with, Danny is a good boy. Smart. Strong. An awkward moment passes between them. Molly turns back to the cell window. Is there a hint of doubt there? Has Louisa hit a nerve here with Molly? Louisa understands now that this woman is prepared to die for her children's future.
Your husband sent for you?
Asks Molly suddenly.
No. I thought you could do with a good meal and a change of clothes.
What else do you think I need?
Molly turns to face Louisa, stern. She holds her own despite her predicament. Louisa places the dress, shoes, and tray of food on the nearby stool.
I didn't mean to intrude.
Molly turns away. Then Louisa spies, on the stretcher bed, a copy of her women's journal, The Dawn. It's a double-sided single page, her first publication. The headline screams, Battered Wives, is it purely a husband's right? She looks at Nate, knowing he must have given it to Molly, perhaps in the hope she would read it and open up to him. Something unspoken passes between Nate and Louisa as he offers her a small, heartfelt smile and a slight shrug of his shoulders. He tried, hoping to get Molly to trust him. Louisa turns back to Molly, still gazing through the cell window.
Ah, my journal. And the audacity of Nate. I guess he thought it might help you to know that we care.
Molly looks back at her, seeing Louisa pointing to the stretcher bed where the page lies, and then back to the world outside her cell. It begins to snow again, and they can hear the soft sound of it falling on the wooden slat roof of the jailhouse. Molly closes her eyes to listen. It's one of the final sounds she'll hear, and it's soothing.
You're right from the outside, she says.
Louisa is taken aback. She prides herself on her ability as a writer to get inside her subject's mind. And considering her own sister died at the hands of her husband, a so-called gentleman, she says, I was trying to give voice to an issue that has been kept silent for far too long. Molly doesn't say anything, so Louisa continues, unable to disguise her frustration.
Trying to give women a voice.
Molly turns to her.
I could only hear you.
An uneasy silence falls between the two women as Louisa considers what Molly has said. It's Louisa who breaks it, saying, Point made. Thank you. She smooths her dress, slightly embarrassed by the comment. Damn it, the woman is right. Molly turns again to look towards the mountains in the distance, still willing her children to make it. Perhaps they're in the warmth of the cave by now. She fills her mind with an image of her children happy, safe, and warm around a campfire, with someone fussing over their needs. Louisa grabs Nate's chair from behind his desk, giving him a look that says, "Please leave." He does. She places the chair before the bars and sits down, notepad and pencil in hand. After a few moments, Molly turns to look at her.
"Can I really trust you?"
"You can trust me." Louisa takes the lead. "Can I hear you? Your story, Mrs. Johnson?"
"Molly. My name is Molly."
"Can I hear your story, Molly?" Taking a deep breath, and for the first time in a long time, Molly smiles. A smile weighted with so much sorrow.
"For my children. Let not my sin overshadow my children knowing my love for them."
Chapter 31. Bare, cold, snow-covered feet step up to the gibbet hesitantly, as if weighted with lead. Molly told Louisa she wouldn't wear the shoes. It wouldn't be her, and she wants to honour her mother. But mostly she wants to feel alive, her senses tingling from her head to her toes as she takes her last steps and last breaths.
"Feel that sharp cold, that sting in the air."
Molly looks at the rope and falters. Nate grabs her elbow, steadying her. One more step to go, and she will have reached the top of the gibbet platform. She begins to search the crowd, looking for someone. The large trooper who stands before her takes the slip knot and holds it out to Molly. Nate directs her to it. He turns away as the trooper places it around her neck and pulls on it, tightening it. Molly is jolted back to reality, to where she is standing and what is about to happen. She looks down to see the rope resting on her chest, rising and falling with each shallow, nervous breath. Nate steps away and stands to the side. He can't look at her and appears very distressed himself.
"Oh, I wish I'd let her go to be with her children. Let the law of the mountain rule for the very last time, an eye for an eye. But how could I? There was no mistaking all the evidence I found against her, especially in the murder of Trooper Leslie. For my own sanity, I have to believe I did the right thing. The murder of her husband could be self-defense, maybe. Her son would have made a perfect witness, having seen what he saw time and time again. But an innocent trooper trying to do his duty? That's what pushed Molly's conviction to the death penalty."
Nate shakes his head to clear his thoughts. Molly stands on the gibbet, hands tied behind her back, rope around her neck. Judge Eisenmenger stands beside her and unrolls a scroll to read out the charges laid against her.
"You, Molly Johnson, shall be hanged by the neck until dead."
Molly searches the crowd. A sea of stern male faces stare back at her. Judge Eisenmenger continues.
"For the murders of John McFarlane, Trooper Spencer Leslie, and your husband, Joe Johnson."
Molly spots Louisa Clintoff pushing her way through the crowd, her black cape held tight around her. They lock eyes. Two other women, one of them Elpida Sava, come to Louisa's side. They hold blankets draped over their dresses, and all three are wearing their brightest item of clothing, a pair of shoes, gloves, and a scarf. They appear to be a little on edge. It's eerily quiet. Judge Eisenmenger leaves the platform, passing Nate, who is looking down at his wife, distressed. Molly and Louisa exchange subtle nods, a silent pact made between them. Molly's gaze finds the solace of the snow-covered mountains. It's a stunning sight, picture perfect. Louisa and the two women by her side remove their capes to reveal aprons over their dresses. There is script written in charcoal on them. Hear her. Battered wives are powerless. Legislate women's rights now. The women join hands and step forward. Some of the men notice, grunting their disapproval. Nate is deeply moved by his wife's protest, proud of her bravery. But he cannot waver from his appointed position of law of Everton. He too looks out to the mountains for comfort and strength. The large trooper steps up behind Molly. Nate struggles to give the final nod. One of the women starts to cry. Molly begins to mumble her Dar's favourite song.
And still I hope that the time will come when you and I will be as one.
The snow on her feet starts to send a tingling sensation through her body, travelling fast up her legs, her subconscious taking over.
And now, there before me is the smiling face of Delphi. The sweet girl holds up a daisy chain necklace, not a hangman's slipknot, but precious little daisy flowers neatly twisted and entwined to form the perfect necklace. Oh, look, there are Joe Jr. and Henry James laughing and throwing snow at each other. See them wave to me? I hope they behave, my little rascals. And now from out behind a snow gum, it's my Danny boy. There he is. My beautiful caring boy. No, my young man. A man long before his time, with all he has witnessed in his 12 short years. See, he smiles and nods to me, encouraging me to go. See, he holds up his fist and blows through it, just as I showed him. His fingers spring open to send this breath and words on the wings of the crow that flies overhead and carries them to me. Always with you. I feel my heart tear, my insides drop, and I feel the warmth of my own piss running down my legs. I will not fall. I will not drop. I am a woman, a Narigo woman, so much more than a drover's wife. My Danny turns to go. He steps out, lively with determination, and I know he and the others are fine. But wait. He turns to give me one final look, and I know I will be remembered. My children give me strength and focus. The mountains. Look to the mountains. That's home.
Nate clears his throat, still afraid to look at Molly, whose eyes are glazed with tears.
Oh, good God, I really have to do this. None of this was in the brief. Come to Australia and run a sleepy town in the high country.
He can't stand it any longer. Prolonging this isn't going to help anyone. He turns to the trooper and nods sharply, then immediately brings his focus back to his wife. She will not turn away and covers her mouth with her gloved hands, silencing her screams as the trooper steps forward. The crow calls to me as it circles again above, encouraging me to lift my spirit, to give my soul. And I do. And I'm gone on its wings. High up in the snow-covered mountains, a tree branch cracks and snaps under the weight of the snow. Molly's boys spin around in fright, and Henry James, worn out, falls over in the deep snow. Exhausted, Denny carries a frostbitten Delphi on his back. Tiny icicles are forming on her closed lashes. It's hard to tell whether the little one is dead or sleeping. The children are dwarfed by the landscape around them. With snow up to their knees, Joe Jr. helps his little brother up and they trudge on. They are close to giving up, exhausted and frighteningly cold. Denny surveys the landscape desperately, They have reached the area that looks as if someone has cleared a space, making a perfect circle. His eyes flick frantically from boulder to boulder, looking for the three large emu eggs. He is on the verge of tears, the burden of saving them all weighing upon him. He looks to the left, he looks to the right. There are plenty of boulders, but no three in a row in the perfect shape of large emu eggs. Then, from the corner of his eye, in the distance he sees a woman, her fire-red hair catching his attention. She stands at the side of a boulder. Danny blinks and she is gone. Thinking he might be seeing things, he comes further around to see where she went and sees the three large boulders standing before him, bold and strong. He's made it. He's done it, as he said he would, for his ma. His brothers come to stand beside him and he nods his head towards the boulders, saying, "It's there. The cave. Just beyond the three boulders that look like giant emu eggs." True to their young, innocent minds, Joe Jr. and Henry James tilt their heads, trying to see the emu egg aspect. They screw up their noses.
"Maybe wombat droppings,"
Joe Jr. whispers with a cheeky grin to his little brother, who agrees. Danny smiles at his brothers. As dire as the conditions are,
"These two rascals."
He adds, "Food, shelter, and in the spring, people." Feeling confident, the brothers take each other's hands and trudge through the snow, following the path of the fair-skinned Aboriginal woman with the fiery red hair. Together, they disappear behind the boulders. Epilogue. When we came back down from the mountains, I was 16. I heard many a story about my ma's so-called man-hating rampage. A mad woman filled with hate. And it's the black in her, people were saying. But then there was the story from Louisa Clintoff. Danny's voice is deep, manly, gentle, and wise for his 32 years. He has grown into a handsome, intelligent young man, tall and strong. He stands beside his new fireplace. A framed old newspaper article with the masthead, The Dawn, in large black print, sits on the mantel. In smaller print, the headline reads, "The Drover's Wife, Molly Johnson's Story." In her writing, Louisa asks, "A crime or justice?" "Survival," I say. Survival as I, her eldest son, knows it to have been. Danny moves over to sit on the couch with his beautiful, pregnant, dark-skinned Aboriginal wife, Nell. She's 28 years old. Danny takes her hand and kisses it gently. Before them, sitting on a possum skin rug, are their six children, ranging in age from 2 to 12 and varying in skin colour from brown to olive to fair with red hair and freckles, just like their great-grandmother, Black Mary, or Warragunj, as they prefer to call her. They all listen attentively to their father. "It's the story I lived. It's the story I have told and will retell. The story of survival I'll pass down." Each evening before bed, for all their entertainment, there is a story, which always leads to a reenactment. Sometimes it's their father reading to them or telling this very story, or their mother telling them dreaming stories of the land and how it came to be. Other times, the children reenact a story they love and know well, the bullock story, paying homage to the legend of their grandma, Molly Johnson. Tonight, the children will play act that very story, the beloved bullock story, the story that Danny lived and has now passed on to his children. He loves retelling this story, how Yarika, a great man, father and warrior, acted out the bullock. He smiles at the memory, but then sadness fills his eyes for a fleeting moment that only his wife sees, and only she knows what it means. The children jump to their feet to tell what's become their story of how their grandmother brought a big wild grey bullock down with a single shot, right between the eyes. Three of the younger children act out being caught in front of the bullock like their Uncle Joe, who is now a drover like their grandfather Joe was. Their Uncle Henry James is a businessman who lives in Melbourne, married to a lady who doesn't like to visit much. but he always makes sure she comes with him and the children for a special day the brothers share. Their auntie Delphi is overseas, living in Paris. She hasn't been back home since she left at the age of 16. Soon, though, everyone will be home for the 12th birthday of Mirabi, Danny and Nell's eldest son. Mirabi will also go through the final stage of his men's business ceremony, the ones his father and uncles learnt in the high country with their Narigo family. Their uncle Bulbure passed the ceremony on to them in some haste. He knew time was running out for ancient practices. Modern ways were invading and destroying everything the Narigo held dear and believed in for their survival. It was after Joe Jr.'s and Henry James's initiation that Molly's children came back down from the mountains. Danny and his brothers are grateful and honoured to be able to carry on something from a culture so ancient, from their family, their Aboriginal family. They hold the knowledge with great pride, Danny more so than the others, but nonetheless, they all stand their ground in defending their culture and countrymen when needed. In the story of the bullock, Mirabi acts as a young Danny, drawing in the dirt floor. Danny's eldest daughter, Molly Mary, acts out his ma. He can see his mother in his daughter, not so much in looks, but in temperament. Danny and Nell have renovated Molly's old shanty to a humble homestead, where the old snow gum still stands sentinel out front. Next to the tree now, though, is a horse rail, and often Danny hears riders say they've seen an Aboriginal man standing there, looking over the place. But when you get closer, he's gone. Danny just smiles and replies, "Yep, that sounds about right." He ploughed and packed that old track that was barely visible, making the property accessible. Nothing to hide here. But there is a significant sized fence and gate that you go through to get to the back door, and you have to pass two vicious-looking dogs called Ally and Gator. And every evening, Danny still sweeps the top layer of dirt to rid it of the day's foot traffic. So I know who's about, be it animal or man. His eldest daughter, her voice deep and husky like her grandma's, says, "Gun, now, slow." Mirabi hands her a make-believe gun, but then their father rips off his shirt to display tribal markings on his chest, a badge of honour from his people. He stomps at the floorboards with his bare feet and begins to mimic the bullock, just as Yarika did all those years ago. This story of the bullock is also a journey from where the Johnsons have come. Danny told it to the Narigo, and they in turn added it to the principles and practice of their ancient culture of mimicry and dance, building it up with song and movement. Danny and his siblings loved that the story was honoured by the Narigo for their ma's bravery and respect for her plight, and that it brought her into the family clan. It was a way they could all remember Molly, but also a way the clan could share in her. It was a proud moment for Danny when the men, women and children dressed and painted up to perform the story for them. Tonight, though, there is no paint or singing or ancient musical instruments, just a simplified version that Danny's children have created. Molly Mary brings the pretend shotgun up to shoot the bullock. They are all very good in their play acting. They have done this before. It's a much-loved story that has been told many times over. Mirabi whispers to his sister, "Shoot him!" She shouts, "Bang!" and makes the pretend shotgun recoil in her arms as their father, play-acting the bullock, falls to the ground, dead. The children applaud and throw themselves on him. His wife claps and laughs, praising them in her mother tongue of the Yirrkala. She looks lovingly at them all as Danny engulfs his children in his big arms. Their laughter and squeals of delight can be heard from outside. Molly's old shanty is now a large family home with a veranda wrapping all the way around it. It sits in the light of the fire pit that still burns, and now electric lights that highlight every room through the glass windows. Smoke rises from the old River Rock chimney at one end and from a new chimney that warms the shanty's new extension. It's picture perfect, this property and homestead sitting in the still of the beautiful autumn night. The large dark form of the mountain range still stands like a fortress wall before them, but the thick scrub that once surrounded the shanty is gone. From inside, Molly Mary asks her father to tell them a poem. They all gather to sit with him on the possum rug. The baby sits on her father's lap and snuggles into his chest, sucking her thumb. He begins. Monero, Narigo, Wolgaloo, country, water, life force, runs through our veins. Boundaries, song lines, we sit down this side. Family, mother, deep ancient connection. Outside, a blanket of brilliant stars fills the sky and a new moon smiles down on the landscape below. By the old snow gum, a woman stands. They have a visitor. Oh no, wait. It's the feminine shape of the tree trunk, exaggerated by the dark night and the firelight. Or is it? Oh, to see these trees after an autumn shower. It's this rare beauty that reminds me why I stay. Molly Johnson's legend and family live on country. Author's note. What a joy and awesome learning experience it was to write this novel. In Aboriginal words, it was deadly. Hard work, but I loved it. I love history. My love for history came about when I was a teenager. I was 14 and wanted to understand more about my Aboriginality, what my mother and grandparents had lost due to government policy, not allowing them to pass on our culture. I was determined to fill in the gaps in our history. Through this research and listening to oral stories from my elders, I put the pieces of the puzzle together and found my spiritual self. My culture has become my solid foundation and has held me in good stead ever since. As a writer, I love drawing from my own family history and Australian history in general to inspire the settings, situations and context for my fictional characters, bringing a story to life through imagination. This is how I came to create the fictitious world of Molly Johnson. I have carried this story with me for 42 years. My mother would read The Drover's Wife by Henry Lawson to me as a little girl. I would always stop her and recite the famous last line, "Ma, I will never go a-drovin'." Then, in 2006, I was in the Australian Snowy Mountains shooting a film called Jindabyne with director Ray Lawrence, and I made a pact with my ancestors and those of the land I was standing on and set a goal for myself that I would be back on that beautiful country of the Narigo Wolgaloo to make and star in a film of The Drover's Wife. As fate would have it, as I was doing the final proofread on this novel, getting ready for publication, I was also starting pre-production on my first feature film, The Drover's Wife, The Legend of Molly Johnson. How's that for the ancestors answering my prayers? But this all began with a play I wrote for Belvoir Street Theatre, with the wonderful support of the Belknaves Foundation and the Belknaves Fellowship in 2014, which allowed me to pen the script. It went on to open in late 2016 to a limited sold-out season of 33 shows. The production cleaned up, winning a dozen or more awards in 2017. On the back of the play's success, I secured a book deal with Penguin Random House and the go-ahead for a feature film. I am proud and happy to say that there is a difference to the three genres that this story encompasses: theatre, film, novel. The novel follows a similar structure to the film and picks up on the backstories of the characters, which allowed me to explore greater depth and development of story. The novel, of course, allows the reader to get inside the characters' heads, to read their inner thoughts. I found that a little difficult to convey at first and was reminded of one of my first ever writer notes for TV. The mentor writer, script editor, said, "If you ever hand a script in again with the character talking to itself, you'll be shot." So it took a little while to allow myself to write the character's inner thoughts into the novel. I would like to say thank you to my elders for their support and guidance. Aniona Cleary, Uncle Michael Mace, Annie Linnell, Minnie Mace, Ma Mace, rest in peace, and Frances Adkins, family in-law and researcher of The Test of Endurance for Hazel Mace, which was used to inform Yarika's story. Uncle Hans Pearson and Sean Chulborough of the Gugu-Yimithir, Paul House of the Gambri-Wolgaloo, and Auntie Iris Smith, Auntie Doris Payton, and Elder Auntie Rachel Mullett of the Monero-Narigo for the permission to use the Narigo language. The story I have created of the Narigo Wolgulu is based on general fact, but fictionalized to protect traditional and cultural practice. Writing The Drover's Wife in all its forms could not have been possible without the unwavering love, belief, and support from my partner in life and business, Bain, who works tirelessly to get my ideas up. I failed English at school, so to have written a play, a film, and now this novel, which I am so proud of, makes me feel pretty good about myself, and I hope I give inspiration to others. Thanks to all the people who helped us to make all these projects come to fruition, and to all who worked hard to get this book out. A special mention and a big thank you to Bain, Manda, Raf, Lysander, and my dog, Odie. And lastly, thank you for the inspiration, Henry Lawson. I reckon he and my mum would be toasting each other in the afterlife just about now. Cheers, ma. That's Blackfella for thank you. Peace, love and light. Leah, kisses. Ateringa yirabayemi. P.S. I hope to do another one. This has been a Penguin Random House Australia audio production of The Drover's Wife, The Legend of Molly Johnson. Written and narrated by Leah Purcell. Copyright, Leah Purcell. Production copyright 2020 by Penguin Random House Australia. All rights reserved. If you would like to find out more about Penguin Books Australia, our authors, upcoming events and new releases, you can visit our website at penguin.com.au.
Audible hopes you've enjoyed this program.